Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's go back to 2011 and look at the World Cup with Squidge. Let's go back to 2011 and look at the World Cup with Squidge.
So I've noticed over the course of lockdown that I've started doing this thing where, like, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately, and I've noticed that I've began, like, responding out loud to them, and, like, not even always just saying, oh, that's interesting, or answering a question being asked in my head and just having to do it out loud. I've just started making, like, small talk, and just, like, sometimes when people say hello, I've started saying hello back. So I wanted to begin this podcast, firstly, with that explanation, and then I'm going to leave a pause for anyone listening to this to say hello back when I introduce it. So I'm going to say hello. Yes, you did look slightly odd saying that out loud whilst out on your government sanctioned one walk a day, but thank you for listening and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective rugby podcast, Rugby, which is a name that's somehow even longer than the ramble I just went on to begin this thing. My name is Robbie, but you can call me Squidge if you'd like to. And joining me as ever,
four episodes in, you're saying as ever. I like it, you're very well trained. But my name, that's not my name, by the way. My name's Will.
that's a howler by a mum there.
Yeah, it's about like a 20 barrel. What's like the word for double or triple when there's 20? I don't know how many words that was. But
20 barrel, let's just go with that. Yeah. And joining someone with a third name, that was a vague link. And join us well.
We have her on because she has three names. That's the criteria.
I feel like the intro could have been worse, guys. It's Rhiannon Garth-Jones. Not double-barreled, just plentiful.
Copenhagen's finest Burnley's Wales rugby pass writer, Twitter. There's an introduction. There you go.
I have developed quite the niche.
Yes. Yeah. How are things going? How is Copenhagen lockdown?
It's not so bad at all, actually. Like, we went into lockdown really, really early compared to everyone else, I think. Like, the 12th of March, maybe. Mm. And Danish people are generally very, very law-abiding.
Yes.
Like, jaywalking is not illegal here, but they will stop you if you try and cross the road. Man. So the lockdown isn't as strict as it is in the UK, but everybody follows it much better, I think. Yeah. And we're starting to come out now. They have opened hairdressing salons and tattoo parlours because everyone knows they are the most important things for society.
No, they are. They are. I've struggled to get through without having any of my toes tattooed recently. No, I noticed that in Japan as well, similarly, when I was in Japan for the World Cup. I had the same thing of, no, because I didn't go. Shit, I've let the cat out of the bag there. you don't cross the road if it's on a red light or even a yellow light. You wait until it's green. And anyone that doesn't, it's not even that case of people stop you. It's people stare at you. And you very clearly are an outsider. And I think that's worse.
Yeah, so like most of the time they will just kind of eyeball you. Even if it's like 2 a.m, no cars in sight.
Yeah.
But occasionally you do get like quite aggressive people. And this is more so in Sweden, who will like full on windpipe you.
What?
Like kind of instinctively just like smash an arm out to stop you.
Oh, not deliberately. Not like WWE.
Do you live around the corner from Sebastian Valmahina?
Yeah.
Yeah, sort of. Valmahina would be absolutely fine here in many ways.
So,
apart from his inability to follow the rules, that would be a problem.
People care about politeness enough to be willing to receive an ASBO for it.
It's not so much politeness, I think. It's more just like respect for the rules.
Okay. But
like they don't have
windpiping someone
for, like,
isn't against those rules.
But they do apparently not. I don't know. I mean, I don't think they intend to do like serious harm. It's just that they're so instinctive and urgent about it.
So I mentioned Japan, and I thought that was going to be a really nice segue into the rugby what we're covering. It's fine. It's fine. The idea is we're covering every game in the World Cup of 2011, and today's, the fourth game in the World Cup, was France against Japan. So, as a quick moment of context, it's quite easy to get lost in who Japan are and where Japan are now. But at the time, Japan hadn't won a Rugby World Cup match since 1991, which when they beat Zimbabwe, and that's the only game they'd ever won up to this point. They came into it against a France team who had done well in the Six Nations. They'd won it the year before, and then it'd sort of been, I think, the second or third this year.
I don't think you can put any tags on this France team, or any France team.
But it was a particularly mental France team.
Yeah.
Coached by Marc Lievermont, and they went on, spoilers, to make a World Cup final, but it wasn't without their own stuttering and their own complete madness. I'm aware as well, you may be able to hear in the background, I've had mice in my flat and I can hear it clattering away because I just caught one before we start recording. And I want to mention that. I want to introduce our other guest, the mouse. There we are. Okay, just as an explanation, because I can hear it really loud right behind me.
It's got a lot to say.
Yeah, it's
clearly a big fan of the Japanese really, front row circa 2011.
Yeah, really, really big fan of Sean Webb, the Japanese fullback. Who actually, so there's a moment in the first minute of the game, and I'm just going to begin like this. So Japan had at fullback a guy called Sean Webb, who was one of their four-part Kiwi contingent in this team. Now coached by John Kerwin, who is himself a Kiwi. And the commentary kept mentioning as well that his mum was in the crowd.
I've written this down because it came up like five or six times. And at one point they were like hypothesizing about how Mrs. Kerwin might be crying.
Yes. And they highlighted, they highlighted, she's 82 years old. Yeah. How dare you? John Kerwin, you're putting yourself in a game and you're putting your mother under stress. What are you doing?
At one point, Lawrence Delalio was like, oh, well, like Mrs. Kerwin can be really proud. And I was like, this is not the insight.
Yeah,
I'm particularly looking for Lawrence
That's
Delalio.
That's pretty advanced for Delalio standards.
Well, it's rare of Delalio to think of a woman in any sense as a human being rather than as an object to be used. But there we go. Also on the commentary, the commentary was provided today by Martin Gillingham, Nottingham's own, who also commented in the opening game. And in that game between Tonga and New Zealand, he mentioned Nottingham four times. Okay, so I've decided to keep this count up and over his every game in the World Cup, start counting how many times he says the word Nottingham or Notts. And today, in France against Japan, it was five. He brought up Nottingham five times.
I'm actually surprised it's not more, because didn't James Arledge play for Nottingham at this point?
Yeah, I think he had a natural talking point.
He could have gone.
Sadly, that was his only segue to Nottingham, I think, at this point. But my favourite thing about this is, how long do you notice he went before bringing up Nottingham after kickoff, between the referee blowing his whistle?
Literally the second the game is kicked off.
1 second passes before he says the word Nottingham.
I'm pretty sure it's the second word of his commentary. He says the Nottingham fly half kicks off.
Yeah.
He must have prepared that. Yeah.
He begins as he means to go on.
He gets paid by the Nottinghamshire Council every time he says the word Nottingham or Meadow Lane. Yeah.
Meadow Lane comes up quite often as well.
Yeah, it comes up once or twice.
Yeah. Yeah, I doubt he mentions Lady Bay nowadays.
No.
Okay, so to quickly run through the two teams, it's a really fun France team, I think. It's Cedric Heymans, Vincent Clerc, and Maxime Maidart as a back three, who are...
Say no more.
Absolutely.
Tim Maidart, like, his sideburns have not aged at all.
No.
In 9 years. He just looks absolutely identical.
I think
like,
maybe...
Like werewolf.
Maybe because he's so rooted in the 70s, he will always look like he should be living then. And he'll never age beyond
that.
He has
a, like, unchangeable appearance. It's really impressive.
Yeah. Which I love. Then they had Aurélien Rougerie, and who is more handsome than I remember. I remember being slightly broken.
Yeah.
But
he's
actually,
a glorious man.
He
there
really
was one
was,
point.
Wasn't
he? One point in the second half where I couldn't tell if it was Dimitri Zarzewski or Aurélien Rougerie running at one point, and I thought that's the ultimate compliment to Aurélien Rougerie.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're both glorious men, and who I'd forgotten about until they started up again, Fabian Estebanez at 12.
Yeah, completely forgot he existed.
Yeah. Big, boshy 12 who was... Actually, there's also a bit in which, I think it's Andy Gomesel on the commentary, says that Ryan Nicholas, his opposite number for Japan, boshed him off. And I heard noshed him off.
Like, I mean, I was laughing at boshed him off, to be honest, but yeah.
I heard something completely different. But while play was stopped, while they were waiting for the scrum resets, there was something entirely different
from
went on.
From the Joe Marr John, School of Conduct.
Yeah, John Kerr's 82-year-old mother just had a heart attack watching the crowd.
Lawrence Delalio was deeply concerned in the studio.
Lawrence Delalio is jealous.
So was Falau.
So yeah, then the French pack was full of bastards. Like, it's a wonderfully French. It's kind of the last great proper bastardy French pack we've seen.
It's like, yeah. It depends. I think the game of bastardry is changing and evolving all the time. So that's I feel like there's a certain type of bastardry to this, which is great.
It's like, well, I read
additional slant on bastardry.
Yes. Like, William Servat, what a bastard in the best possible way.
Aaron Aldicky, likewise.
Aaron Aldicky. Like, and again, they had Barcelona starting, but you had Jean-Baptiste Pou on the bench, you had Nicolas Mas. And like, if your name is Pou, you've got to be hard, haven't you? There's no getting away from that.
I love Nicolas Mas. I was so excited when I realised he was playing in this game.
He's great. And again, both their second rows, Julien Pierre, Lionel Nalle, who both scored tries, as did Pascal Pape when he came off the bench.
Mad.
Who were, two of them are bastards, and one of them is a shithouse. And all three
which
of them are shithouses. All three of them are shithouses, but only two of them are bastards.
Shithouse comes with a certain amount of wit, I think.
Yeah.
Are you saying that Nalle's the one who's not a bastard?
Oh, Nalle's definitely a bastard. Nalle is the most bastard.
Which one isn't a bastard?
Pascal Pape.
Pape is just a shithouse.
Yeah. I think Pape ventures into dickhead territory rather than bastard.
Yeah. His categories
are so many confusion. So many nuances.
Okay.
The entire podcast just on the level.
So, hypothetically, what's Alan Wynne-Jones? Because I think he qualifies as a shithouse, but he's not a bastard and he's not a dickhead.
He's a cynic.
Yeah. He is a cynic.
Okay.
And a shithouse.
Yeah.
Sort of, like, his cynicism means that he kind of rises above sort of average level of bastardry and dickheadery, I think.
I like that. Also, God applies.
The algorithm is weird for this.
The Japanese team had Luke Thompson opposite him, who is a... See, okay, I think Luke Thompson just about qualifies on like the lowest level of bastardry in the best sense of bastardry, but I don't think he hits any of the terms we've used. Yeah,
I think he's not someone who you look at. You look at that Japan team and think he's probably the biggest bastard in the pack.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't put him in another team and define him that way. Like, he wouldn't call him a bastard. If he
That's a very interesting point in terms of, because I mean, you've got your Horiers and guess Kikitani's and a very young Michael Leach, which was a bizarre thing to look at. And they don't walk the line of bastardry, but they're on the edge again, as you say. So not quite the same level as Luke Thompson, though. He pushes that boundary.
So can we just... Like, the
He's really... like a designated bastard, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's like trying really hard.
You need that in your second row. You need a designated bastard.
You've got a little C next to Kikitani's name, being captain, and next to Thompson's name, you've got DB, meaning designated bastard.
Yeah. Can I just... So the really young Michael Leach, because he looks weird, doesn't he?
It was very weird. He's aged well, I think.
Yeah, he's grown into his face.
It was weird about a minute into the game seeing that skinny lad playing open side looks bizarrely like Michael Leach.
Yeah.
Because... It was really funny, actually, this team had, like, four... Because it's so, like you said earlier, it's so hard to look at anything they did without the, like, lens of hindsight.
Yeah.
Especially because of lots of the stuff that they did. But, like, it's really interesting that four of that team were just this team in the last World Cup. Like, Tanaka's there, Jota Hori's there, Leach. And, I mean, Thompson, like, that's mad.
Yeah.
That 8 years on, they were, like, kind of finally living the dream.
Yeah. I had a weird sort of moment of realisation because I looked at this game and kind of thought, like, I mean, I remembered what happened, but I sort of thought, well, I need to cast my mind to the time when Japan weren't very good. Mm. And then during this game, I increasingly realised Japan weren't that bad, were they? Which is a weird transitional phase, I guess.
Oh, I think that, like, this team looks a lot like, you know, if you, like, watching them, you're like, oh, I see how all of this happened. Yeah, like, I see how you got good.
Yeah. Like, you can see the kind of...
kind of perfect these things.
It's like they're... A lot of it's working, but, like, their bore attention isn't quite there. And there's a few bits like that, like their decision-making at times isn't quite there. And
it's
you
not
can
quite
kind of...
slick enough and...
No.
Yeah.
I found that... I'm just not, like, practiced enough, I guess. But
yeah, I found that their patterns of play were pretty good, usually.
Yeah.
But sometimes they'd struggle to maintain that over two or three phases.
Yeah.
And because Tanaka was providing such quick ball, then suddenly they'd go, oh, no, when he's getting to phase, like, immediately.
Yeah.
And anybody outside our ledge would suddenly go, oh, wait, sorry, I'm not deep enough, or I'm not wide enough, whatever.
Like, I don't know where I am. There was a bit where I kind of hadn't clocked it was Tanaka, or like I just sort of spaced out for a minute, and I was like,
just like a, "Who's this 12-year-old?
What a fantastic like supply line of amazingly fast scrum halves Japan have!" And I was like, "Oh no, wait, it's just the same guy."
Same one. He's been there forever. He's wonderful as well. He was so good. There's a bit as well where he'd just taken two quick taps on Japan penalties in a row. And then, literally, as one of his forwards comes over and grabs him by the shoulders as the penalty's given and pulls him back, like just so that he can't get the ball to his feet, so that he drops
it. He was
it
playing
instead.
Like a kid on sugar, wasn't he?
Yeah.
The whole game with his clinical quick tap addiction.
There's a bit where he gets stuck. He gets stuck at the bottom of a rock and immediately, like, I think maybe it's Arlis that steps in or someone does and they just like immediately fuck it up. And the commentator's like, I should have waited for Tanaka to get back out there.
Yeah.
I'll try and do anything without him, guys. And I was like, always sort of fair.
Always wait for Fumi. That's my new motto. Yeah. I've got about 4 points. I've just written the words Fumi in all caps, which isn't helpful when you're looking back over notes. the Tranduke's try, the interception try, is entirely because of the sheer speed of ball that Fumi's giving them, and it gets them going forward to such a degree, and they're. It's so weird to look at it now because they're playing so flat. Like, Arlidge runs this loop and he's basically in the defender's face. Like, he's right there as though he's carrying it in. And it makes it really easy for them to read and intercept.
This is just as people were learning what line speed meant as well. Yes. So Tranduke could just shoot up and take the ball from what was a very telegraphed move in the end.
Because it's that thing where they discovered line speed in defence, but they hadn't yet discovered depth in attack.
Mm.
And so...
The combat bits had not kind of arrived.
So
I have written in capitals in my notes at least twice, hands, exclamation mark, and Tanaka.
Is that hands positive or negative?
Oh, definitely positive if it's in caps. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And for Japan.
Yeah. Oh, there's a few moments of really lovely Japanese handling.
And there's a few moments where the one pass away.
Mm.
Yeah. And things like, there's a, I can't remember which prop it was, but one of the props chipped ahead and it like...
Oh, Horier.
Yeah.
Actually like, bit of a fuck up, but was just such a beautiful thing to watch.
And it's the
like,
fact
it went
that
wrong,
he...
but the skill was there. It was amazing.
It's a proper banana kick as well.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's a full on like...
his body.
Hernandez banana kick, right? Yeah, he turns his body and he drops the ball on the inside of the boot so it curves back in on the bounce.
It's the kind again, of thing where, like, absolutely criminal that it didn't come out for him, like, just such an impressive piece of skill. Like, oh, I'm so sad for you.
Again, we were talking in the last game, the Fiji-Namibia game, about suddenly you realise the cameras are on you and everybody's watching, and Horia just kind of thinks, like, right, I've practised this in training enough times. This is my first game in the World Cup where everyone's watching me. If I don't show this off, I will not be able to sleep tonight.
Yeah, like, this is happening.
And at that point, young hooker, it's not quite like the confidence of him to try it against Ireland when he tried that little grubber last year.
Yeah.
But this one... This one, just bam, no, thumping it. I'm going for the fanciest kick possible.
I can remember at the time we compared him to, we just said like he's just a wannabe what Brian O'Driscoll who doesn't realise he's wearing two on his back.
So the reason I ask about hands good or bad, because Japan running through the team, they had these four Kiwis in the side, right? Who were James Arlidge, the fly half, who also, I looked this up, when Dan Carter made his first start in Super Rugby, age 21, his opposite number was another young Kiwi fly half by the name of James Arlidge.
Wow.
That's mad.
Can you imagine going into that game going, oh, we've got to battle these two great young Kiwi tens. One of these could be battling for the All Black shirt for years to come. Not realizing one of them goes on to be the greatest fly half to have ever played the game. And the other one's Dan Carter.
Dan Carter's only been to Nottingham once. James Arledge, however?
James Arledge went to Japan, played there for a few years, and then signed for the Dragons. Played for the Dragons for like 2 or 3 years.
Great flash.
Yeah. And he was all right. I remember him scoring a try against Gloucester. That's my one main memory of him playing for the Dragons.
Nice.
Yeah.
I remember him missing a conversion against Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Who wins? Rhiannon, decide for us. Which is a better
anecdote? No memory. Gloucester are funnier than Edinburgh.
Okay.
That's true.
Intrinsically. Like conceptually. Sorry, Will.
That's fine. That's fine.
I'll leave it to you. I promise. I'll meet you in
So, the interesting thing as well about James Arledge is, so I realised as well when I was quickly Googling him whilst watching this game, that he played in his professional career, he played for, I think it was Northland, Targo in Super Rugby, fight, whatever, who cares. Discard that. From that point onwards, he played for Osaka, he played for Nottingham, and he played for the Dragons in Newport. And I realised he must be the only player who, every team he's played for in his kind of his senior professional career, I've stayed and slept overnight in that town.
That's...
Because I was like, that's impressive, because I once slept in a church hall in Newport.
You did, I can confirm
and
this.
And I grew up in Nottingham. And
his answer right there.
Yeah. It's not an impressive stat. Yeah. It's not an impressive thing to have done. But, you know, that's my little tie to James Arledge. I feel a personal connection to this average fly half.
Yeah. But he was basically...
I'm excited to be in the pub quiz where this comes up.
Arledge was basically... It was basically just him and Kitani were the only players that we really knew going into this game.
Yeah.
So we didn't really know what to expect from this Japan team, it's safe to say.
So you had Endo had scored 2 tries in the last World Cup. He scored 1 against Wales and 1 against Canada. So there's a few players, you know, Onozawa had been in the Japan team for years and he scored like a billion tries against the Hong Kongs of the world and the kind of lower ranked Asian teams. As you say, it was quite a mixed Japan team. As I began saying like half an hour ago, the four Kiwis in that team, you had James Arledge, you had Sean Webb at fullback, who I'd kind of forgotten about.
Yeah.
But he kind of summed up, again, this thing of like, and I remember someone saying this to me when I was in Japan, which I haven't mentioned I ever went to, in that Japanese rugby has this real obsession with New Zealand, and they kind of view New Zealand as like the peak of rugby, and they kind of automatically assume that, you know, he'd played like lower league rugby, and they'd assumed a Kiwi coming into the team was better than a Japanese player, just on merit.
Such as Murray Williams on the bench.
Exactly. So you had Murray Williams and Sean Webb. And like Sean Webb's first touch of the game, France kick it back and he catches the ball and he has like 30 yards and he literally just jogs right into Arunordiki. And like he doesn't even build up ahead of steam. Smart he just decisions. Jogs into Arunordiki.
All the players to aim for as well.
And he has time as well to weigh up where he's going to run. And like there's space out wide. And he goes, nah.
Anywhere but Aaron.
Yeah. That big Basque shit house. I want him. I want to run into him.
Except, make an impression.
Except I think it gets even worse in terms of the calibre of the Kiwi players they're bringing in. Because at 12, they had a lad called Ryan Nicholas. And I want to give you a stat that I picked up on from the game. Ryan Nicholas made 6 carries, he made 6 passes, and he made 6 knock-ons.
Does that mean he's 6 times as good as Tau Felice?
Yeah. So Ryan Nicholas was fascinated because I kind of looked at him and I was like,
"That's remarkable."
I was trying to think about this as like, imagine the selection meeting where they bring in and they're like, "Okay, we've got 2 options to play 10, right? One of them can catch the ball." He's like, "Okay, I like it. I like the idea. I like the idea. It's core fundamental of rugby. I like the idea of having a 12 who can catch the ball." Yeah, and they went, "Okay, we've got who's the other lad? Who's the other contender?" And he goes, "Okay, so he's a Kiwi. He doesn't have opposable thumbs, but he was born in Otago." And they go, "That guy, him, we need that lad.
12.
He sounds quality. I want the guy
straight in the team."
Yeah,
right in the team.
Bizarrely, yeah. I didn't notice that he knocked the ball on that many times. I thought he actually played fairly well, Nicholas.
Those really good kicks for one of them's
runners out. Being that 6 knock-on level.
But there's, so he knocks on about three times.
There were a lot of knock-ons in this game.
Yeah. He also, like, he's
not been alone.
Oh no, it's Tranduk. I was mixing. I just assumed the moment of shit handling was him. it wasn't. It was Tranduk. But there's a moment in which Tranduk turns his body to try and pass, do like an out the back pass, and he just drops the ball behind him.
My favourite thing is you can audibly hear Steve Walsh laughing at him when he does it.
Yes.
I'd miss that.
Trying to like keep his mouth zipped.
So there's this point as well. Steve Walsh, great to see him, as always.
Yeah, I miss
him. But no beard. Clean-shaven Steve.
Weird, isn't it?
I know.
And I couldn't see the tattoo either.
No. Mm. His hair was very silky, though. Like, he specially conditioned it.
It looked lovely.
It was. Yeah. I'd admire him on the big screen.
Like he admires himself.
Exactly.
I did notice that, as always, obviously he always really enjoys being in the centre, but like the way he was dismissing the physios every time they came on, like, good, don't allow time wasting, Steve, but perhaps just check if they are dealing with a real injury before you sort of like shoo them off.
Yes, and he made Estebanez go off, but not allowing them to bring somebody on. He's just like, just go with it.
Classic, yeah. Steve Walsh. Just like, I have no time for this shit. Don't interrupt the Steve Walsh show with your minor injury. Get off the pitch.
And speaking of the Steve Walsh show, in that way that Steve was committed to making the game flow at the expense of the rules.
Yeah. Steve rules were being played.
France's first try, which was finished by, what's his face, Julien Pierre.
Yeah.
Which is, I'd completely forgotten about, and is kind of extraordinary to watch.
It's great. About six Japan players go rucking so far, they forget about the ball.
So yeah, Japan go to clear out over the ball, like, and it's a really good contest. They technically perfect everything. They get over the ball, but they get so far over the ball that they leave it behind.
Just abandon the ball.
My favourite thing I noticed on a replay is you can see Michael Leach just stepping in at scrum half behind, and he kind of looks down. He's the first person to realise they've stepped over Maxime Maidar, who had the ball, and they've just let it go. And he turned around like, what were you pricks doing? What's that? And he sort of just looks at them, and he kind of throws his arms out in a like disbelieving shrug. Have you really just did that? You just let him make a clean break because our entire defence has rucked over and forgotten where the ball was.
Lads, this is the World Cup. Come on.
Basics, guys. The basics.
This is the thing we've been preparing for months. Yes. This is what you've been working hard for, and you can't spot where that bloody egg thing is on the floor.
So we're just too caught up in like finally winning a game so that no one had talked about their one and only victory.
Yeah.
Which came up like about eight times.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But I felt very bad for Japan fans by the end.
Mm-hmm. It's just as well they're speaking Japanese rather than not. Maybe they just all want to hear about Nottingham. Maybe that's what the Japan fans are there for.
Zimbabwe and Nottingham.
Yeah. And John Kerwin's 82-year-old mother.
Mrs. Kerwin,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Maidar then, like, without releasing the ball, just picks it up and starts running again in, like, he can't believe his luck moment. There's then a bunch of offloading, a bunch of stuff. And then, on the floor, yards out, Yashvili offloads it, and one of the French players drops it. And Yashvili just picks it up again while he's lying on the floor, still held, and pops it up to Julien Pierre, who scores. So, Steve Walsh misses the same law being broken twice in the space of 30 seconds, but 30 metres apart.
I think Steve Walsh just doesn't accept it's a law if it's a good try.
Yeah, yeah, just fair enough.
Which I like.
At that point, though, if you're like Imanol Aaron Ordicky or like Helani or somebody like that, surely you just think, well, if I'm allowed to just keep going with the ball and somebody tackles me, I'll just get up and keep going and just apply that for the rest of the game.
I mean, yeah. That's absolutely what you should do with Steve Walsh at charge.
Yeah. And Steve
see
Walsh.
See how long it lasts.
Steve Walsh should always be in charge.
Yep.
Because he can control himself.
And he therefore controls the game.
Yeah.
It's deep, that. It's really,
Miss Steve.
Really quite deep.
It's profound. We should all take a moment, really.
Yeah. Remember Steve.
For business.
Like he died.
It's worse. He's out there somewhere and we can't admire him.
We can't admire him. And he can't admire himself on a big screen in front of 80,000
people. On a big screen's in business.
don't think there are. In maybe rugby, he is. Definitely are.
Maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe he started a big screen business so that he can just start up staring at himself. Maybe
it comes with like a sound system, so you can pretend that there are in fact 8,000 people.
Yes.
Yeah.
In an atmosphere around you.
Maybe he's always in like Skype meetings, so he can always just look at himself.
That's true. Oh, can you imagine Steve Walsh in lockdown? This is a separate sitcom, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is the lockdown TV show we all need, I think.
To then touch on a few of the other tries. So James Arledge himself scores 2. Dan Carter, previous day in the World Cup, didn't score 1. So who's the best fly half? Yeah, Carter's rubbish. Confirmed. Who's the best?
Yeah. Arledge's first try was hilarious. Like, so, absolute credit to him for having like the instincts to recollect the ball. Ricocheted.
Because the best thing is, that grubber kick is never on. Like, there's no space behind there. They just kind of bounce into his hand and somehow opens up a gap to the try line.
So, for anyone that didn't see it, like, it's about 5-10 metres out from the line. Yeah. Arledge goes for this pointless-looking grubber kick. As you say, wouldn't have worked, wouldn't have come off. And it just ricochets off one of the French defenders back into his hands, and he goes, "Oh, right." And he just scores.
Yeah.
And it's just, he just, like, there's a
slight change of direction to his credit, which makes it work. And yeah, good instincts, but just what?
And do you want to know the funniest thing about that? Is that Andy Gomersall on the commentary compares him to Benji Marshall.
What?
There's some truly golden moments on the commentary for this.
There's also, though, his finish in really diving around. Who would it be? Would it be Cedric Heymann? Whoever the cover is for France.
Yeah.
He really goes out of his way to dive over it. You then compare that to Leon O'Nally's try in the second half, where you've kind of got Nally's just on the end of this move, and he's got like 20 yards unopposed on this side of the line. He can dive on the left, he can dive on the right. He's got one defender in front of him, and obviously he goes head down and straight into the guy. He's got
grounds him, then the ball.
I can go round him, I can go under him, but I'm gonna go through him.
Which is an absolute shithouse thing to do when scoring a try.
Yeah.
Take a man out with you, pointlessly, unnecessarily. Just, you know, impose yourself. That's perfect shithousery.
Absolutely glorious. Shithouse and bastardry there.
What I think was weird about that try was that Vincent Clerc was the man who stood in 10 and set it up. Huh. And, like, I've realised, I don't think I've ever seen Vincent Clerc pass the ball before.
No.
And, like,
Vincent Clerc does pass the ball. Are you thinking the same thing?
No. I was thinking when he did pass the ball, I was, for a second, I thought Vincent Clerc was playing at 12. And I was like, what the fuck is it with France and playing people in mental positions? Yeah. But they don't belong. And I had like a whole 3 minutes to myself getting really angry. And then I was like, oh no.
Looking at where he's playing. Yeah. Where are you stood, Vincent? Are you playing at 7?
I'm with Will. I'm not used to seeing him pass the ball.
So there is a moment in which Vincent Clerc passes the ball where he takes it. He then runs like properly laterally sideways right from the touchline. And he stood literally on the touchline as he takes the ball right into over past the midway point. And then he spots the space right out on the other wing and he goes to throw a pass but just chucks it along the ground. And he's achieved nothing in the space of about 20 seconds. He's run sideways and then thrown the ball at the floor.
Maybe this is why he doesn't normally pass the ball. Maybe he's under instructions.
That's exactly it. Ball.
True.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Like, even if it's on, Vincent, it's not on. It will not be on if you do it.
Stick to what you do, which is quickly putting that ball down in that corner. Yeah. Which he did. He scored one of them tries, which I think is really interesting because that is a move that would work nowadays.
Yeah, that was a proper 2015 try, I reckon.
Yeah.
Because in the first two games, we saw just a regular forward shape of these days, as we've called that before, called back for crossing.
Yeah.
Whereas that one, obviously Steve rules, you can basically do whatever you want.
Yeah,
but they ran that normal move, no crossing called, and guess what? It's a really good way of creating an overlap. People should start doing this more.
And I like that then Andy Gomersall says, often that'd be called back for obstruction. And well, actually, it wasn't really obstruction because you're allowed to stand your ground. And that's why referees have come on to not give that as obstruction.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that that was the thing. That was what people felt. People felt, oh, that's a problem. You can't.
It was particularly weird to hear that like anything might have been called for obstruction.
Yeah.
Because like, what?
It just looks like a normal try now. It just looks like, you know, they've forward screen out the back. backs do some nice stuff. They target the 13, bam, Vincent Clair scores in the corner. The only bit that doesn't work in 2019 is Vincent Clair.
And you never know, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. As long as he isn't passing, he'd probably fill in. Maybe that's it. Maybe he should now be a 12. Now he's going to step in as a... Ryan Nicholas has shown you don't need to have hands to play 12. So
just run forward. As long as you drop the ball in a way that's useful.
Ryan Nicholas did again. We spoke about Jacques Berger before. He did. I think it was Nicholas did another really impressive knock on, the sort where you make about 6 yards just from throwing the ball so impressively far forwards and away from where all the French cover is.
There's a certain genius I always think it would be too incompetent.
Yes. Just the
sort of the chaos that comes from it, like a true sort of incompetence against like an actual organised team where they're just like, I don't know what this is. I don't know how to deal with this. Like, what is happening in front of me? And you just get some absolutely brilliant moments, especially in World Cups when that happens. And I feel like Ryan Nicholas is a great example.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it's also kind of this entire France team in that they're just beautifully incompetent and mad. And yet often they just do, they just kind of disappear or they just do nothing in like a, right. Do you mind if I go on a potentially long tangent?
Please do.
Or a different tangent? Yeah, okay.
Follow up thoughts about France.
So what this France team reminds me of, right, is I'm going to assume, neither of you have ever seen the classic of Thai cinema that is Uncle Boon Mi who can recall his past lives.
No.
Funny you should say, no, I haven't.
No, okay. Okay. Neither of you have seen Uncle Boon Mi who can recall his past lives, which is that's the title of the film. Like, that's not a Wikipedia summary.
I think you should pause here in case there are listeners who have heard it and want to yell out like, yes, yes.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I love Uncle Boon Mi who can recall his past lives. The director's got an insane name as well. He's I'm going to check it.
Murray Williams?
But yeah, so the director is called Apichat Pong Weerasethakul. There you go. That is quite a name. Yeah. So the film Uncle Boon Mi Who Can Recall His Past Lives, right? So it's a film about a guy called Boon Mi, right? And he can recall his past lives. Except they never actually explain that he can recall his past lives. And also, like, naming your film like that is like calling your film Captain America Who Sometimes Throws His Shield. You know, it's like it's too on the nose a description. And also, like, I'm pretty sure he doesn't have a nephew or niece, so I'm not sure why he's Uncle Boon Mi. But, you know, anyway. So it's like, yeah, calling
that's
him
monorific.
Yeah. My cousin's mate, Steve Rogers, who sometimes throws a shield. So yeah, anyway, Uncle Boon Mi who can recall his past lives, right? And there's the film is like is really slow. It's like the first 5 minutes of the film are just shots of a cow. And it's just like a cow walking around the field.
How the hell does this link to France against Tom in 2011?
It's going to get there. I'm excited.
So, yeah, it's just this cow walking around the field. And then like, it cuts to a shot of a demon monkey, right?
It's the cow man from Claire.
That cow represents Fabian Estebanes. No.
The cow grew up to become Antoine Dupont.
but the film's really slow, and like there's all these long shots of like just him sitting around and just being talking to this woman, just being like, you know, oh, I've got this mate who came from another country, and he's like, oh yeah, what's he like? He's like, oh, he's fine. He's gone to town to buy something. You know, it's just like them having like almost small, the kind of small talk I like to have with people on podcasts, back and forth. You know, that kind of thing. Of just like nothing happening. It'd just be like 10 minutes if you sat in this like locked off one shot, like no cutting away, no cutting into close up or anything. Of just these two people having like really boring conversations. And then there's one scene again, like 20 minutes into the film or something, which is like two shots in. You know, we've only seen one cow at this point, in which there's like a dinner scene, and there's these two guys and this woman sat around having dinner, and they're just chatting about nothing at all. And it's like, it's kind of boring. And then out of nowhere, a ghost appears in an empty seat, and it just like fades in over this shot that's been there for like 3 minutes. And this ghost just appears, and Uncle Boo Me is like, oh, it's just Boo Me. And he's not my uncle. Is like, whoa, that's my dead wife. She's just appeared as a ghost. Why has that happened? And his dead wife's like, I felt like it. You know, I fancy popping back. And he's like, oh, cool. That's good. It's good to see you. That's great. And they have a bit of a chat, but not like profound things. Just like, oh yeah, the rice is good tonight. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I spent ages cooking it. And then a demon monkey comes up the stairs, just out of nowhere. Just this demon monkey walks up the stairs. Ask you now, do you think I've made this film up?
Yeah, I was about to, question that.
Did you dream this?
No, this is a real... I'm sure this is a... I've seen it. This is a real film. It's in Thai. It's got subtitles, so it's important. And so there's this demon monkey comes up the stairs, and everyone's like, whoa, it's a demon monkey. What's this massive, terrifying demon monkey doing here? And the demon monkey's like, no, it's okay. It's okay. I'm not scary. And they're like, well, I think you are. You're like a demon monkey with red eyes. And then the demon monkey's like, no, it's me. I'm your son. And he's like, no, because my son isn't a demon monkey. You know, I think I know my son. And he's like, no, I'm your son who disappeared like 10 years ago. I've become a demon monkey.
John Kerwin's.
And it's John Kerwin's mum. And the demon monkeys sort of then like he sits down and he begins talking about it, and like he's like, well, why are you a demon monkey now? I don't get why my son became a demon monkey. And he says, well, so I got really into photography. And he's like, right, okay.
Me and Will are both head in hands here.
Yeah.
So it's everyone listening.
And so he begins like, he's like, well, one day I was just taking a bunch of photos, and I took one of a demon monkey. I was like, oh, cool, that's a demon monkey. I'll follow that. I take loads of photos, so I became obsessed with these demon monkeys. And he's like, right, okay, that's cool. I'm glad you got hobbies, son, but that doesn't explain why you're a demon monkey now. He says, oh, right, well...
Before you continue, are we over halfway through this story yet?
Let's keep going.
Let's find out.
We're like 20 minutes into the film. you tune into this rugby podcast to hear, like... beat-by-beat recreations, play-by-plays of Thai cinema. Yeah, and the demon monkey's like, well, it all happened because I mated with one of the demon monkeys. And he's like, oh, right, okay, that's cool. And he's like, yeah, I took one of them as my wife. And he's like, oh, congratulations, son. Well done. I'm really happy for you. And it sort of goes on like that. There's a bit where a woman is in the water crying.
Now you're light on specifics. God, I'll prove it.
She's like crying about how ugly she is to like an empty river out loud. And then she hears this voice that's like, hey, I think you're dead fit. And then she's like, well, who said that? And he's like, it's me, I'm a fish. And so she has this conversation with a fish who's like, I think you're really pretty. And then she walks into the water to meet the fish, and the fish is gone. And then she just starts floating in the water. And then she has sex with the fish and grows gills. And so the film Uncle Boo Me, who can recall his past life, right, I think is an awful lot like this France team, because
oh my god,
it's in stages
way to make the point that this France team are mad
in right okay no because in stages this France team is really dull, and like in all sense of the word, they're inaccurate, they're boring to watch at points. They just do nothing, like nothing is happening for large stages when they've got the ball. But you're so captivated by it because
you didn't
they're
make it sound like nothing was happening.
They're completely mad.
Quite a lot,
but that's it. Because the film is like 2 hours long, right? And most of it is just shots of cows doing nothing and just people talking about like rice and shit like that and just nothing. But then every now and again, a ghost will appear or a demon monkey will talk about like how into photography it is, or just something like a woman will have sex with a fish and grow gills. And just mad shit happens that you're kind of captivated by it, and it ends up, the end result is weirdly beautiful. And I'd never recommend the film Uncle Boomy Who Can Call His Past Life, even though I quite like it. I wouldn't recommend it because it's actually really quite boring for the most part. But because there's these moments that work in it, you're kind of captivated by it and fascinated by it. And that's how I feel about this French team.
I mean, I think there is a point in there. quite close to the point that I planned to make about 4 years ago.
It would have been short.
I've never heard of this film.
To just watch the film, Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives.
Can you guys remember we were talking about James Arledge's Grubber Kick? Doesn't that feel like a month ago?
This is like a sort of meta version of lockdown, and that we have managed to exponentially extend time. No one now has any idea what the fuck is going on.
So, I thought that was important. Look, I've been pulling aside like Brett Goldstein and all the hosts of the podcast I've been listening to and going, hey, can I just talk to you about the Thai film Uncle Boonmi Who Can Recall His Past Lives? And all of them have been saying, like, most of them can't hear me because they're on podcast. They're not real, they recorded it ages ago. Most of them can't hear me, but whenever I ask them that question, they just say no, and I can hear it, and I need to get that out of my system.
You just put it on two people who can't, who have to listen to you.
Yeah.
I'm glad we could oblige.
It's the only reason we're doing this thing, the only reason we're recording this is...
You can vent your various obscure cinema references.
Exactly, so that I can talk about demon monkeys.
So which match from the pool stages are we going to replace with an episode on Ponyo?
Oh, just you wait. Just you wait until I get into, like, the moment I compare the entire French squad each to which Eric Rohmer movie are they? Which is, but because all of Eric Rohmer's films are basically people talking about how they're thinking about having
an
affair.
Stop right
there. So, yeah.
Can we have a veto?
Yeah. So, does someone else want to talk about rugby?
I was going to say that as a collective, this French team are shit.
Very eloquently put, Rihanna.
As individuals, they are occasionally fantastic. So they're not so much a Jekyll and Hyde team as they are not a team.
Yes.
A bunch of random, individually excellent players who occasionally take it upon themselves to do something.
Which I would say...
in this game, but also throughout this whole tournament, I think. Mm. Like, in every game, one or two players were just like, I will deal with this bullshit... get out of my way.
Yeah.
They didn't do that and then they lost.
I think I'm going to throw out somebody who I think was particularly telling for was Morgan Parra.
Yes.
When he came on out of position at 10 to fix this mess.
So yeah. I had this.
They looked
thought.
A lot better with Morgan Parra at 10, which made me really
weirdly,
angry.
Weirdly, they did.
I rationally hate Morgan Parra.
Why do you hate Morgan Parra?
I think I hold him responsible for the semi final game.
Ah. Right.
Okay. I think, like, I've sort of emotionally processed the semi-final and not blamed anybody except for... Well, no, I mean, I haven't, obviously, because I like have violent fantasies where I inflict harm on Northern Power. But in terms of the Welsh players, I have processed it. I don't hold any of the mistakes against anybody. Mm. It's all fine. These things happen, except that I hate Northern Power more than any individual has been hit. Well, in all the time.
I quite
but
like...
He was good.
I quite like Morgan Parra for the reason that he is so hateable, because he is like he ticks all the second row boxes of shithouse, bastard, dickhead, all of them.
French,
yeah,
the most
French
important, yeah.
From half, these are all things that I would normally kind of admire about him in a sort of amused, you're an arsehole way, instead of the like distilled pure hatred that I feel.
So can I just say it by
I
the way?
Apologize to Parra fans. I realise it's unreasonable, I'm sorry.
Can we call them parasites?
Yes.
Big fans of Morgan Parra. There you go. Yes. Coin that. Can I just say, why on this film podcast has everyone just talked about rugby for the last 5 minutes? Because I think most of the runtime has been dedicated so far to Thai cinema.
Let's not prolong that tradition.
We need to get back to obscure films, sorry.
Yeah, no.
also, related to your... insanely rambling analogy. is that France managed to score 6 tries in this game, yes, and they had 2 tries disallowed, and yet the overwhelming feeling is that they very nearly lost the game and yeah, were generally remarkably incompetent. The most amazing vibe to give off in a game like that.
Most French.
Isn't it weird to think that with 5 minutes to go, Japan were on the French line looking for a losing bonus point, and then they go and concede 2 more tries down the other end?
It was actually a really interesting example of, like, it wasn't that the sort of, like, underdog team weren't fit enough and that's why France scored 3 tries at the end. It's that Japan weren't giving up. Yeah. Like, all of my sort of chronological notes are just like, Japan are still somehow playing. Why are Japan still going? They're 21 points down. That's like 1 minute to go. Why? The clock has gone red. Why are they trying to score? It was just so, you know, the reason they lost so badly is because they were so unwilling to give up.
Yeah.
Just like a really quite amazing thing.
That Nale try, and even more so, I guess, the Pape try, they just looked so tired.
Before we go on to that, there's a great moment in which actually, as I say, Japan are looking for a losing bonus point. They've just coughed up the chance and they clear it long and they manage to, off second phase, work an overlap, and it looks like they've actually got a really, really good chance. Yeah. And then they pass it to Ryan Nicholas, who just drops it under no pressure. And they also, as well, there's a similar moment around that time when I've forgotten his name, the big fat Samoan lad they brought off the bench.
Tupaeli.
Tupaeli. He can catch the ball, but he just, like, I'd forgotten.
Tunnel vision.
Yeah. I'd forgotten this era of centres they picked because they were big and couldn't pass. Like, that happened
quite a lot. He was a Japanese Bastero, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Except Bastero did have some talents. Yeah. I'm not sure this guy did, really.
No. Yeah. Because there's a moment where he runs into someone and they kind of bounce off him, but he doesn't give up. So he begins running sideways until he can find someone smaller to run into. And he then begins to run into them. And the thing is, he looks over, he sees Onozawa, who is the quickest man on the field, is completely unmarked.
Yeah.
And if he gives the pass, fine, grand, you know, like, Onozawa's away. He's only got the fullback to
beat. I think. Yeah.
And, like, we then see that after he's tackled and he knocks the ball on, he kind of scoops it forward as though he was trying to pass it forwards to Onozawa. And we see Onozawa then takes it and he tries to run downfield and he's in the process of beating the fullback when it's called back. And you just, if he could have passed, or if you'd played it nowadays and players like him weren't allowed, you weren't allowed to be a centre, you literally can't pass.
Yeah. I'm surprised Steve Walsh didn't ban that at any point. You're too fat. Sorry, you need to go off.
Sorry,
you've
mate, you're shit.
The ball. Get off my face.
Your fingernails are dirty. Go get sorted.
Yeah.
You know that, like, amazing anecdote about getting Jenkins once, like, a water boy came on and he just went over and grabbed the coach mic and yells, like, get this player off, he's playing shit. And whoever the coach is, substitutes whoever the player is. Like, I cannot in some ways believe that Steve Walsh has never done the same thing. What are you doing? Get this fucking idiot off my face. He's ruining my game.
He referees Dan Parks and just goes, no, you're not playing like that under my leadership.
I reckon at some point Steve Walsh and Gethin Jenkins have done that and, like, called on each other. Just like, can we get a new ref? Can we get a loser?
That'd be great. So you were talking about the Pape try.
Yeah, that was gloriously mental. Obviously, at this point, you don't really want France to score because you're thinking, oh, come on, let's see Japan get a point. And then in comes Morgan Parra just doing weird sidesteppy things, which I've never really seen him do before.
Yes.
And Yashvili with what I would coin a very disrespectful reverse pass to set up a try.
Yeah. Oh, outrageously so, yeah.
There was that point, though, with about the last sort of 10-15 minutes, Yashvili just dedicated his entire game to just doing reverse passes. He was so committed to it.
Which is such a, like, such an odd flex when it's like, you've been under a lot of pressure for quite a substantial part of this second. Like, now is not the time. You know, like, if you were 50 points up, sure, do whatever mad shit you want. Be as disrespectful as you like. Like, you're not. You were quite close here to being tied. Why are you doing this?
But Yashvili was a proper shithouse, though. Like, he was doing it clearly because it would be disheartening for the Japanese players.
Oh, yeah.
And also, I think, because he knew that he couldn't be taken off.
Yeah,
because
that's
Parra's
true.
Parra's already on the pitch. It's like, what the fuck are you going to do? Like, how are you going to stop me?
Well, you're thinking
like
of doing something.
For Yashvili shit else.
My favourite Yashvili story is a quick tangent. Freddie Burns' first European Cup game. Like, Gloucester's going in the corner against Biarritz. And he goes to take his first conversion and he can't find his tee. And so he has to just put it on the floor and kick it. Yeah. And then a few minutes later, Beerit score, and Yashvili lines up the shot, and he stole and burns his tee. And the best thing is, he didn't need the tee. He stole it because he knew they had a debut top 10 and it would get in his head.
Can I just say, I knew this anecdote, and I'm pretty sure it's because Will told me.
Yeah, I think I did. Okay.
Made that even funnier. Yeah. But yeah, it is amazing.
That's a great
result. Was it like, who was it who stole Mauro Tojji's?
Rattes. Yeah.
Also outstanding. What a dick move.
This is great shithousery. Shithousery World Cup.
There's especially also throwing it the extra bit away. No.
Just as he's reaching for it.
Yeah, and it tells you goes the rest of the game without putting it back on.
Teeny tiny Vincent Rattes and the longest player in the world. stretching, but not. Oh, it's amazing.
There's also a moment just on the Pape try where, as Pape's about to go over the line, Van Zonkler points at the try line and points to put it down. As like, this is what you're doing. This is what you do now. Like,
I don't punch anyone now, Pascal. Yeah.
And it's like, in a way, I thought it was patronising, but then I realised if Van Zonkler was in a line-out, he'd want a few words of advice from Pascal Pape. Yeah. So it's like, this is what I do. I realise this isn't your area, Pascal. It's from more than 1 yard out.
Don't get angry.
You put it down. Helpful. Normally, when I do this, the team is wearing green and it's the last 5 minutes. But otherwise...
I think that was the try as well. One of the commentators was like, that's not a bad finish. And I was like, what is your scale?
Yeah.
What's zero on the scale?
I was thinking of that Joe Van Niekerk one. That must be on YouTube and stuff. Where he goes to dive and he slides onto his knees and then slides across slowly. He does it's almost like an IKEA furniture thing. He slowly unpacks himself onto the ground.
Yeah, he was the perfect midpoint between Year Six School Disco and Chris Ashton.
Guys, I don't need to watch this now. I exactly understand what happened. The perfect description. I've always kind of quite respected Ashton's, his finishing style, because I've never seen him fuck it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also Everybody wonder wants him to. How much has he practiced to never fuck it up? Like, imagine what else he could do with the time he spent practicing that.
Learn to tackle.
Yeah. Maybe he could become a world-class kicker. Maybe he could scrum. There's so many possibilities of the things that he could have turned his hand to.
Imagine tight head Chris Ashton.
It's called Dylan Hartley, isn't he?
No, because Dylan Hartley doesn't have the redeeming feature that Chris Ashton has, which is lovable northern accent.
Yes,
fair point.
Yeah.
You really, really hate him on the pitch. It's exactly the same with Farrell, and he gets off the pitch, and I'm like, oh, still so strong.
I'm one of the six people who likes Chris Ashton. I'm the only one.
I'm one of the six.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm one of the six. I
found half of them here.
Chris Ashton's it's the other half, his wife and two daughters.
Yeah. I think they all live in Wigan either way. But
I don't know, I just kind of respect him.
Yeah, yeah. It's the way he plays. I love those support lines. They do slightly funny things to me.
It's like it's like an easy thing to say about him, but nobody does it that well.
No, I've never seen anyone.
Charlie Morgan wrote an article on it last week, I think, or the week before. Yeah. And I was like, I don't even know why you bothered to include anyone else in this. Like, why would you not just make an entire article devoted to every support that Chris Ashton has ever
wrote?
There's no need for anyone else. Like,
it was Charlie Morgan's bit when he analysed his performance off the bench against South Africa a couple of years ago. And he said that he'd ran, I think it was 300 metres without the ball in the 10 minutes he was on the pitch, and four with it.
Yeah. But all of the stuff he does, that's what's so amazing about him.
Yeah.
That ridiculous way that he just embarrassed every top try scoring record there'd been in the top 14 in his one season.
Yeah.
He was like, oh yeah, it's just because Semi ran down the game with the ball. And it's like, yeah, but you ran something mental every game to always be there on his shoulder when he had the ball.
Exactly. Oh, he's so good.
Yeah, he's remarkable.
He's a completely different player to the ones playing in this game. But you know, I hate tangents. I don't think we should ever go on long tangents.
I didn't get to that one.
How did we get to doing half an hour on Uncle Boo and me, who can recall his past lives?
That's all Pape's finishing.
Though, actually, on England players, should we pick up on the punditry?
Right, yes, because can I say the great one, I do understand in general why they always do the pivot of like, let's talk about England.
Mm.
Like, it's infuriating and it's hilarious, but obviously most of their audience is English. Like, fine, I get it. And I get it in this game that England-Argentina was next and that was probably the big game of the day and all the rest of it. But, and I wrote it down and went back to check that I'd heard it correctly, straight after the kickoff from Japan's first try in the second half, so the game is finally poised, the momentum is with Japan, it's all there for an amazing World Cup story, and the line is, there is an Englishman involved in the contest tonight, the assistant referee on this side.
Who I'd never heard of as well.
Nope, no idea who this guy is. I'm like, what? And it was so, like, there was no context for it. It's not like before the try happened, someone was talking about England. Like, it was just nothing at all. It was like, I don't know what to say. So, and that guy's English.
Yeah. And in 2008, he had a train journey. He stopped in Nottingham and bought a pasty in Greggs. Just to crowbar it in somewhere.
I mean, honestly, if that had happened, I would have had more respect for the crowbarring.
Yeah.
Nottingham would have made it funnier and more worthwhile. Utterly unbelievable.
At half time as well, so one of the punches I think we'll very much touch on, but there was also Francois Pina, who, great respect for him, you know, wonderful captain and generally very good pundit, but he has one moment, I just enjoyed the phrase, where he began talking about Dmitry Yashvili and you could see the sentence getting away from him as he went on, and he then just said, and he plays, and he sort of stops for a moment and realizes he's got no idea what he's going to say, and he just repeats himself, he plays. And then he stops, and kind of by this point, the clip they were showing of him has stopped and gone back to him, and he just says, he plays wonderful rugby. Just because he couldn't work out what he was going to say.
A lovely sentiment.
It's kind of like someone had said to him, you know, on his first, just before his first gig, like, if you ever get stuck with what to say, just either pivot to, he plays wonderful rugby,
yes.
Or he hasn't played, you know, like, and in that moment of panic, his mind just went back to, wonderful rugby. I really like Francois Pina as a pundit, partly because I think he does a really great job, aside from all the technical stuff, of looking very relaxed and very suave.
Yes.
And there's always someone sat next to him who looks like they're trying really hard to be relaxed and suave and really fucked off by how much better Francois Pina is doing it. And
I'm
in this
also...
case, it was 100% Laurence Sorario.
Yes.
I also am a fan of Francois Pina's punditry. He's a wonderful pundit.
Very good.
Yes,
the thing about Francois Pina as a pundit, though, is I'm always worried he's going to like pick up a pen and just kill someone next to him, then wonder how he did it, because he's Matt Damon and that's what he does in the Bourne movies. There's a little Invictus joke for you.
In this scenario, I would have been all right with that outcome.
Yeah. he just stabbed Lalio in the throat. And no value is lost. The punditry remains exactly the same quality as it was.
The camera just quickly pans to Danny Kerr's buttonless shirt.
Yes.
Stays there for even longer than it already was.
So yeah, let's talk about Danny Kerr's buttonless shirt.
Honestly, I think it had no buttons.
Yeah.
There's no excuse for how deep it was otherwise.
It's a proper plunging neckline, isn't it? Like, there's cleavage on show.
It's the kind of, like, you couldn't wear a bra with a neckline that deep.
No. Oh, no, absolutely like, not. Like,
you couldn't even wear, like, a fancy, well-constructed sort of deliberate. Like, no. No underwear in that shirt. Absolutely not.
It's the kind of neckline you get on, like at the Oscars. You know, I'm expecting, like, a flamboyant man from the E! Network to come on and critique it. Like, it should be, like, rose-petaled shirt.
Or like you're on some sort of ridiculous yacht in Ibiza and you've like put on your shirt to pretend that you've got dressed and you just like really so casually do one button at the bottom, like, yeah, you can still see my nose.
This was it. This was my
TV
first
studio.
My first thought when I saw it is like, has Danny Kerr just invented Love Island?
Has Danny Kerr been flown in from Love Island? From a yacht somewhere?
I also found that Danny Kerr was sporting the most lockdown haircut I've ever seen.
Yes. Bad all round from Danny Kerr, really, visually.
Oh, but wait, because he missed the World Cup. He missed this World Cup with an injury. But did that injury stop him being able to do up his shirt properly? Like, was that it? Could he not...
Did he injure both hands?
He injured both hands. It's a really specific freak
accident. So did Ryan Nicholas.
Is that the only shirt he owns? Like, does he not maybe have a casual t-shirt? Or a polo? The wardrobe.
He turned up in just Quinn's kit. He hadn't got changed since the game he got injured.
Lots of flip-flops and a Quinn's shirt.
Next to Francois Pienaar being poised.
More successful than Danny Kerr. He was also doing a very unconvincing recline.
Yes.
Which just accentuated the terrible shirt and the fact that I don't think his blazer fit him very well.
No, it did. And I think that was probably deliberate to accentuate the shirt.
The shirt, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the years have been kind to Danny Kerr.
I think that, yeah, he looks a lot better.
Yeah. Because he kind of looked like he was trying too hard, even if his shirt was done up.
Yeah, there was a strong, teenager trying to look like an adult vibe about him.
Mm.
And, failing miserably.
He's got his fake ID to get into the studio.
Yeah. Like, I'm here as a pundit. I've got to look grown up. I've got to say smart things. I've got to have, my dad's blazer.
The other thing on the halftime break was I want to quickly mention the adverts, because there's one advert in particular which was a squirrel watching The Hacker. I don't know if either of you watched this or you skipped the adverts.
No, I skipped the adverts.
No, I kind of
I was sort of only half paying attention. I do remember there being an inexplicable squirrel.
It's a great band name. Great. I wasn't a fan of their second album, Inexplicable Squirrel. So there was just an advert where it was just a squirrel watching The Hacker and talking about how scared it was. But the squirrel was alone in the living room, which seems to imply either the squirrel broke into the house and had erected a tree there for it to live in, the squirrel was being kept as a pet and could speak English, or the squirrel owned the house, which is like a true kicking dirt in millennials, isn't it? Like, you can't afford a house, but this bloody squirrel can.
I think at this point we should consult with the mouse, who might have
a rodent inside. The mouse has actually just got itself a new home.
Who is in a house.
And it's going to be the... I was going to say it's going to be the cemetery around the corner from me, but that sounds like I'm going to kill it.
Is that the Inexplicable Squirrel album?
Yes, the cemetery around the corner.
The cemetery around the corner is locked.
Yeah.
Famous Smith cover band in many ways, Inexplicable Squirrel.
I think, does that about cover us? Do we have any other thoughts? Anything else we want to bring up on France v Nippon?
I only have one thought.
Okay.
For obvious reasons, I think. And I wrote it not only in my actual notes, but in my summary notes.
Mm-hmm.
That Rougerie gets completely upended at one point.
Yes.
And not only is it not a card, it's not even more of a penalty than the one given for in at the side. I just watched it and Steve. I was like, okay.
There's a few high tackles completely ignored as well. You look at and now it's a penalty, that's a yellow card. But no,
I mean, I think in general, I kind of have a rule, especially for anything further back than 2015, I'm don't even bother.
Yeah.
Not even bother trying to be like, that would be a red card now, there'd be no players on the pitch. It's so pointless.
Yeah.
But given what happened later in a game that France played in that very same World Cup, it was a little bit on the nose.
That didn't happen.
Yes. But that is a complete watershed moment, isn't it? That's Sam Warburton tackle.
Well, so I do always say, when people were complaining about the high cards and the red tackles in the last World Cup, I would just kind of say constantly, you know what? Get fucked. You are talking to Wales fans who all, most of us at least, kind of say, you don't see tip tackles anymore because of that red card. It was a good thing. It had a good impact on the game.
Yeah.
Arguably a little bit unfair in the context of the tournament, but the net impact has been a good thing. It ruined our game. We lost the game. But, if those red cards in that World Cup had the same impact, that would be a good thing. But also, not even a penalty.
No.
Yeah.
It was bloody, Rougerie and beautiful hair.
Rougerie does have beautiful
Steve
hair.
Steve Walsh would have felt, concerned for that.
I think Steve's jealousy, looking at that, walking onto the pitch and having the third most beautiful hair once Starzewski's come on.
Yeah, perhaps I wonder if he gave any sympathy
points. You are really in Rougerie. With your beautiful hair. I'm glad you've got mud in it.
Yeah.
Possibly some blood.
Maybe that was why he started laughing at Tranduc, because he had a little envy towards his hair at first. He's like, oh, I need this guy to screw up. He scored a try. He looks beautiful.
I don't see how your immediate response to the existence of Tranduc cannot be to laugh. Like, I don't think it needs more than that. Like, he's just there. That's funny. He exists. And, it's hilarious.
Like, Tranduc has the haircut of someone that has one line in Les Mis.
I'm glad that sentence stopped there.
Yeah, that's as far as I'm going on this one. Don't. If you let me carry on the Tom Hooper tangent and let me bring up Cats, we're done.
No.
We're done. We're doing another 4 hours. But I'm not going to mention the C word or the word cunt. But instead, I'm going to move on to the...
Hi, Mom.
Hi, John Kerwin's 82-year-old mother. Who would very much be my man of the match, which I think we'll move on to now.
Ooh. Oh, I totally forgot about this.
So did I, to be honest. I'm not going to lie.
Get thinking. I've got mine, so okay. Should I lead on this while you're thinking?
Please.
Yeah.
So, my man of the match. One contender, I guess, was Yashvili for mostly just doing filthy stuff towards the end. Mm. But in the end, I went with Cedric Haymon because... he would often start counterattacks when Japan started looking a bit competent. Mm. And suddenly he'd just go, you know what? The way we beat these guys is with mad shit. So yeah, I've picked Cedric Haymon.
He was definitely one of the individuals who was like, I'm just going to take charge for a while now, lads.
Yeah.
Let me just deal with the situation.
Yeah. Have any of you got a man of the match yet, or should I continue?
So I think I've kind of got two contenders in mind. And I think, so Fumi Tanaka, I thought, was outstanding for Japan and a huge factor in everything they did well. Like that, we didn't mention that second Arledge try, but that's entirely just the speed he gets them playing at. Yeah. And he then...
And Arledge, of course, hitting a crash ball and leaving both Francois Tranduc and Aaron Nordicki on the floor.
That was... Yeah.
Defies physics.
I think Arledge might be my man of the match for that.
Yeah.
Like, leaving Aaron Nordicki in his way like that was just absolutely superb.
Fair play. And scoring the weirdest try of the tournament so far.
Yeah, exactly. The double whammy of like ridiculously funny accidental try and knocking down a mad bastard. Especially because it was like his first World Cup game and they like kept zooming in on him to see how nervous he was and stuff.
Oh.
Really mean.
Bless him. My other contender, speaking of bastards, is Leon O'Nale, who I thought was great and did all the second row shit as well as just... delighting in joining in backs moves and then being a shit out about it, and just kind of like, he didn't throw a punch, but I was half expecting him at any moment he could try and sidestep someone and punch them as though he was beating them. It was that kind of game.
It sums up Nally so well, because you'll have like your 10 will pass to him and then loop round and think, like, oh yeah, this is going to look good, we can send it to somebody out the back. Nally will just every time dummy back to the 10 and just think, no, I'm running into somebody here. Thanks for passing this ball, you're not getting it back.
I do think also, for the same reasons that you gave, Will, Maxime Médard was quite good. He did lots of kind of just like, I'm going to deal with this shit now.
Yeah.
Ran some really kind of nice lines, just imposed sporadically, but importantly, competently.
Yeah, that's a fair call.
Yeah. So,
I feel like we covered well there.
Yeah, cool.
But now you have to start again, Will, on Dick of the Day.
Okay, so I'll start with my second choice stick of the day. My other contender was Dmitry Yashvili again for a point in the second half where France had loads of pressure on the Japan line and they were about 5 metres out. And Yashvili picks up from either a scrum or a ruck, picks up to go on the blind side on the right-hand side, drops the ball and tries to style it out as a grubber kick. And Steve Walsh just goes, no, 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 you knock that on. Showed him no mercy. But...
honest, as always, Steve Walsh is a strong contender for man of the match.
Oh, yeah.
Very fair call. Yeah.
We've got to add like an asterisk of except Steve Walsh.
Yeah, except for Steve Walsh.
Yeah.
It's not fair that you win.
My actual dick of the day, we haven't mentioned him yet, but it was David Skrela.
Yes,
because he came on the pitch to turn the game just as Francois Tranduc was starting to crumble. He got the ball 3 times, got turned over on all 3 of them, including 2 knock-ons, and then gets injured on his 3rd touch and goes off. Para comes on, so he's replaced by a scrum half who's playing out of position, who only goes and scores. So both the starting 10 and the guy who replaced him both scored, whereas all he did was get turned over.
I did actually write, because I knew that for the rest of the tournament, Pyro played at 10, and I could not remember why. And I did actually write down, is this David Torella character why Pyro is at 10 for the rest of the tournament? Before he got in. She's like, what the? Who? I don't remember this guy. Why is he so fucking useless? Maybe this is why I don't remember him.
Okay. My dick of the day. Two votes for Skrulla. My dick of the day is, of course, the one and only Ryan Nicholas.
Fair enough.
And I also, so I went and actually recorded a clip from the commentary of Andy Gomesall when he began to praise Ryan Nicholas. And I think this sums up his game quite well.
Nicholas is inspired at the moment. Ryan Nicholas, he stepped out of the line to rush Trinduk. Missed him, but...
such a swerve. What's he doing before to describe him as inspired?
He's playing so well. He missed a tackle, but never mind.
He's trying his best.
I would
best,
like Andy Gomesall to commentate me playing with me, I think. It's fucking useless, but all good.
Perfect. I think that brings us to a close. My mouse is very eager to go out. And my mouse, I've adopted them now. Very eager to go outside. Very eager to go out and see Uncle Boon Lee, who can recall his past lives.
The trap?
He loves it. I'll drop the trap. It's fine. I'll deal with you. We'll have words. Rhiannon, thank you very much for joining
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Rhiannon. That was good
thank
fun.
Thank you for having me. This has been hilarious.
It's been educational.
Yeah. Yeah, we've all learned a lot about mice. About Uncle Boomy, who can recall his past lives. Which, like, that's
the,
can you imagine?
About patience?
Yes. About squirrel-based bands. We've learned about Danny Care. We've learned an awful lot, and hopefully
the listeners have learned something.
Yeah. Hopefully
and not
you'll
to never tune in again.
Yeah, that's it. Hopefully you'll join us to learn more again. Because
hopefully
we
learn us on the Steve Walsh appreciation.
Yeah,
that's true. We're changing our target market.
Yeah. It's the weirdest curriculum you'll ever come across. But
new branding.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And I'll say good night and leave a chance for you to say good night back.
Good night.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.